Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator for the Limark Technical Net. We've been going strong with the net for 44-plus years. Every Sunday night, we sit in front of our radios and chat with each other and educate each other, inform each other, and hopefully entertain each other. And I thank you all for joining me once again this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we're going to try and do it all over again. So let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual links. Okay. If you want to reach me via email, one of my email addresses is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you have a space-aided story or want Paul to take a look-see and give his opinion, his email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. I cut and paste a bunch of interesting articles, YouTubes, what have you, and I put it in a link page. You can get to the link page by typing into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll be up 24/7. So any night you might have a bad case of insomnia and you want a reading list of what I found at least to be interesting, you can pull it down. We usually offer a chat room, but the chat room is still down this week as well, so I got to contact Chatsy and ask them what the hell has happened, as it's not only affecting me, so it may be early signs that the business is running down there. Who knows? We'll see. Also, we offer an audio stream on the Internet of the Technical Net, and we keep it live the rest of the week, so don't have a radio on you. But you do have Internet access. You type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that will give you an audio stream of whatever is going on in Glen Oaks. And as always, I like to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.t. It has archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back to September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of people who've moved out of the area or unfortunately become silent keys over the years. But up for a second, and I'll be right back. Okay, what we have planned for tonight, standard vanilla edition, no guest speakers, unfortunately. I have a little bit to say about artificial intelligence and a follow-up on a topic we were talking about last Sunday. And then we'll go straight to questions, comments, and topics of interest. I'll ask people to hit their push-to-talk buttons, give me your first name, your call, whether it's amateur radio-related or just science and technology. As always, we prefer the first few questions to be amateur radio-related. But as the night progresses, we will accept any science and or technology-based question and do the best that we can with it. That should hopefully take us approximately to 10:15, and Paul WS2N will join us for the SpaceNet report, and that shall take us approximately to 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the plan. If my shack doesn't misbehave and the repeater doesn't misbehave and I don't misbehave. So we'll see what happens. Most likely I'll be thrown off of All-Star at least once or twice during the night, but hopefully it won't cause too much of a mess. I do want to mention that I would appreciate if everyone doesn't quit key during this particular technical net, especially because of the weather, it's possible that we might get some emergency trap. And if everyone quick keys each other, it's going to be difficult for the traffic to be able to be heard. So keep that in mind, at least for tonight. Generally speaking, none of us should quick key, but I understand that people get emotional and they want to say their response as soon as humanly possible. So that's what we got planned for you tonight. I'll drop for a second, and we'll go into the AI. It's a very short AI presentation. Okay. Interesting. Two major AI companies announced pretty much the same thing. They both decided to go into the health business. So both OpenAI and Anthropic announced that they will have an agent that specializes in both professional and unprofessional discussions about health matters. The unprofessional one is the one focused for patients and, you know, general public. The other is a product that's more geared towards the professional, the physician and such. If he needs a consultant and he wants to use a AI agent instead of a human being. So this will be fascinating to see how it develops. I remember when WebMD became a thing and what a mess that was. So we'll see if we hear any horror stories about this. Unfortunately, you give these AIs a bit too much rope, and they hang you and themselves together. So that's the only real big announcement. They're tweaking things, but no amazing report. I do want to correct an error that I made last week. We were talking about quantum computers. I think Gary brought it up. KA2UT, and I mentioned that so far using pure quantum computing, it was only able to filter the product of a 15, 3 times 5. Well, that was based on a previous research that I made, and they've been working real hard in the last year. They report that they now can factor the number 21, that's 3 times 7. So at this rate, they will be able to crack RSA internet encryption in about 3 or 4,000 years. But hopefully they'll speed up the process. So we'll see how things continue to go for quantum computing. But I wanted to correct myself to you gentlemen and ladies, I hope someplace there, because I always want to give you current information, and it is subject to change over time. If you blink, you miss an advancement in science. So that's all I got for you up to this point. I think it's a perfect time to go to the main sequence, the main episode, the main portion of our technical net questions, comments, and topics. So I hope you people out there have some subjects to roll around, because that's the whole point of the exercise. So with that in mind, I will drop my little push to talk and ask people to push theirs in and give me your first name, your call sign, whether it's an amateur radio relay question or subject or science and technology.
WB2AHK, non-amateur radio.
Okay, Wes and Chet recognized. Anyone else want to put their name across?
Alpha Echo 2, Yankee Golf.
Okay, Sam recognized. Anyone else want to put their name up front? You know, it's always good to put your name at the beginning of the net, so it's, you know, more likely that we'll get to you if it's a long list. But you can do it anytime you want, but it's always nice to have a few people on the list at the beginning of the technical net. So once again, I ask if anyone else out there has any questions or comments or topics for discussion that they would like to do throughout the night, then, you know, hit that push to talk and put your name on the list.
WS2N. Yeah, you could put me on the list, Roy.
Okay, very good. Okay. Wes, is your topic going to be on the long side or the short side? Would it, we kind of slide you down a little bit, or you want to stay at the top?
It's up to you.
I'm not going to be long, I believe. Just general questions.
Okay. Well, what do you got for us, Wes?
Yeah, when I was talking to you today over the email, I noticed that I have AI, Gemini, plugged into my email, and it analyzes our discussion. It looks like somebody's reading what you're writing, what I'm writing, and making their own opinion. And the question is, can I somehow read out of it? Back to you.
Yeah, you operate through Gmail. Gmail has hooked up their Gemini AI so that it's aware of everything in your mailbox. Again, talk about privacy. So I don't know if you can opt out of Gmail's Gemini hooks into your mailbox. I would assume you could, but I would also assume that they're not going to make it particularly easy. So, yeah, this is a known problem. One of the many reasons why I don't really use Gmail as my primary mail server, because those strange little engineers over at Google are subject to doing all kinds of foolishness with Google. I mean, Ice is certainly right, but still, you know, my mail server is you know, stuck in the old ways and not likely to hook me up to an AI. But yeah, unfortunately, this is our brave new world here, that Gmail is hooked up to Gemini. So that theoretically, you can click that little button on the Chrome browser that says use Gemini and ask it about stuff that you wrote in your email, God knows for how long, you know, because, you know, most people don't delete their old email. They just forget about it.
It looks like they want my input, whether they properly interpreted the discussion. So what they say is, video suggesting life originated elsewhere and traveled to Earth, referencing Neil deGrasse Tyson. Roy countered the astrophysicist's lack of expertise in organic chemistry, unlike Jeff, who is a chemist. Roy further stated that Tyson's opinion holds less weight than Jeff, who has a PhD in organometallic chemistry. And it says about me that I acknowledge Roy's point, but questioned Roy's rejection of authority and introduced a synchronization analogy. Well, talking about the synchronization analogy, you act like a supercomputer, extremely fast, and when I was writing the response to whatever you wrote to me, you were actually responding again, and that was actually that problem that was mentioned in my email, which was a contradiction in synchronization. but anyhow, the point that I have, that's the second one, and I'm going to end up with the third one shortly. Okay. So the problem was that Jeff and Tyson, both of them shared the same idea, so they didn't differ in opinion. When we're talking about what you wrote to me, and also I have a question to Paul, because Tyson made his video based on International Space Station. will be kind enough to comment on that mold on the ISS. And so Titan said, if we have a mold on ISS, and it's the space station, and there is nothing around, somebody brought it there. So, but it could be that inside of the rock or something that was able to hit the Earth, there was something that was life that was brought to Earth. And the video title is "Where Did the Life on Earth Came From?" Dr. Roy, back to you.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure exactly, because you kind of threw a whole bunch of things simultaneously. So you wanted to know if Paul wanted to comment on the mold that they saw growing on the ISS. You know, stuff grows, and I don't think they completely decontaminated, sterilized everything. So, you know, they bring a lot of stuff up. Spores are very strong and can survive all kinds of ridiculous things, and then they just kind of sprout. A lot of people here on Earth have a lot of problems with mold spores and mold in general. You mentioned the theory. The theory exists. I don't think the majority of people in the field believe it's true. The problem is organic molecules are not the most stable and durable things, especially long-chain ones. You know, you have polymers of specific, DNA, base pairs. And if you get the base pairs wrong, you get mutations, and usually they're destructive and lead to death. So the idea of having cellular matter, and you have to protect it a great deal. A major part of NASA's expenses is to make sure their astronauts survive the flights up and the flights back. Without that expertise and that money, you're stuck with comets and meteoroids. And they heat up when they hit the atmosphere, and they usually decompose any organic material. So is it possible that life came from another world and just seeded here? Yeah, it's possible. Is it likely? No, not terribly likely. I can't give you the exact odds, but they're rather significant. So, that's where it is. The theory exists. People mention it. It sounds better than just life began on Earth, because everyone's kind of used to that. So if you're a popular science grifter and you want to show off to the audience, you give them the latest, greatest, least proved theory, and you're good to go. What can I tell you? I mean, Tyson is a very smart gentleman. He does have a PhD in astrophysics. I don't think he's really done anything with it since it's PhD, and I read his PhD. But he kind of grabbed Carl Sagan's crown, and he even has stories he tells about how Carl Sagan invited him up to the university and signed a soft cover back book, and he kind of presents himself as the crown prince of Carl Sagandom. So I don't know. I find popularists in science that are successful and make a lot of money a little grifty, personally. They might be wonderful people. I remember discovering Michio Kaku, and he's a bit of a used car salesman some of the time. Again, very smart guy, wonderful credentials, did significant research before he kind of turned to the popular science grift, but sometimes some of these guys kind of rub me slightly the wrong way, but that's just a personal thing, I guess.
Thank you very much for that, Dr. Roy. A question, because AC2PL, Jeff, and Tyson, both of them, they have the same idea, right? Why did you say that Jeff's idea was dismissed? Back to you.
No, and I don't really want to talk too much about Jeff behind his back. He might be listening, but he might not be. No, I didn't say that. I said that that Jeff dismissed that theory when you brought it up, I don't know, 6-7 months ago. He didn't agree with it. He thought that organic molecules are not stable enough to make the assumption that falling comets are going to are not going to destroy a significant parts of organic biochemical molecules that create and maintain life. So he didn't agree with Tyson.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. So I believe that Jeff was right and you are right, and we say we talked about the chances that life originated somewhere in space and was brought to Earth because of temperature, because of the atmospheric requirement and whatsoever. I would say one on scale of 10, what would be your opinion about that?
Let me get this right. You want me to kind of give the odds of whether life began outside of Earth, going from one highly unlikely to 10 being very likely? Was that the question?
That is correct. I gave one.
Okay, I'll just throw out a number. 1.5.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for that. Paul will be able to give some information about mold in ISS and Tracy.
Okay, we'll ask Paul. Paul, would you like to comment on Wesley's question about the mold detected in the ISS?
KF2ZC online.
Okay. Welcome.
Do you want to pick him up first, Roy?
Yeah, just a second. Welcome, Brian. Do you have any question or comment for tonight, or are you just checking in?
Yeah, go ahead.
Try again. That was all noise.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Didn't really answer the question I asked, but okay. So Wes, are you done, or is there anything else? Oh, yeah. You wanted Paul to answer the question about the mold. So, Paul, take it away.
Well, mold is a popular topic on the ISS over all these years. It gets caught up by the filters. You know, the air is constantly recirculated through all the 15 different modules. And they do have filters on the intake, everywhere throughout the ISS. So they tend to get rid of those, replace filters every now and then to prevent molds from building. But one of the recent topics was there was mold on the outside of the ISS. That they were investigating, and they sent that back to Earth, and the scientists are curious, how could this stuff, I guess I don't know if the word is live, but survive on the outside of the ISS for months and years at a time. So they were studying that. I haven't read any updates, but they've done that on a couple of times over the decades. I believe the Russians were involved in a project like that as well. But I know it's an ongoing thing with mold. So, and they have to control that. Last thing you want is going on a 3-year mission to Mars, having a mold mold problem, you know. You're going to have to make sure you bring enough filters with you, and then you got to get rid of it. I don't know if you could, let's say if you had mold on a filter, you know, can you put, like, rubbing alcohol on it? I don't think that would kill it, you know. They probably have to, you know, deep sick it, send it out to deep space to get rid of the filters. Not sure what, you know, long-term problem. And could you imagine having a colony on the moon and Mars? So they do research this, and they need to have a cure before they have these really long-term, you know, space projects. Back to you, Ryan.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, George?
Very interesting topic. But what would bring mold? Higher levels of moisture. Okay, let's start there. Back to you, Roy.
Well, you shouldn't really have any significant amount of moisture on the outside of the ISS. It's not a complete vacuum, but it's a near vacuum, and so, you know, moisture would kind of boil off the surface of it, I would think, and unless you have some kind of a leak in the structure of the ISS that's feeding it from the inside, which is, I think, the most likely reason. It might be microfractures, but I think you kind of need some kind of connection with the internal portion of the ISS to maintain mold and spore formation and all things like that.
If I got this correct, you're talking about mold. So, yeah, we're in it. It's not leaking. It can't be leaking because they really can't survive if it has any level of leaking. But how is it between human intervention? Has anybody discovered anything or studied anything about that? Back to you, Roy, And of course, Paul is in there, whoever else. KD2FI, you listening? Very interesting topic.
Yes. Well, it was my understanding that they took a sample and they sent it back to Earth to analyze. So, yeah, it's been poked around. I'd love to kind of know, you know, whether it's a pure mold deposit, or a lot of times mold will interact with bacteria and have a complex structure, and so maybe there's some anaerobic bacteria going on in amidst the mold. But you know, it'll be interesting to see if and when NASA kind of reports to us public of what nature of the mold that's on the outside of the ISS might be made of.
Or things inside. I don't know, but that's a very interesting topic that was just brought up. KD2FIU, I'll be on the side. Thank you, Roy.
Okay.
I believe Tyson was talking about resistance of mold to space environment. So, if mold could survive outside ISS, the mold could be brought inside or rack or whatever from outside. But then when it comes to Earth atmosphere, it becomes extremely hot. So that's why I gave 1 out of 10 bacteria.
And that's why I gave you 1.5. There are organisms that can tolerate extreme environments beyond belief. The problem is that re-entry in a structure that's just a rock is not really the best way to maintain any kind of living organism. So you basically guarantee to sterilize whatever kind of plummets out of the sky and lands on the ground. I mean, you know, there are all kinds of fungus that can survive as spores in incredibly difficult environments, but there's only so much can do. You know, reentry is kind of a traumatic experience. So, you know, I mean, there are tardigrades that they brought up and dehydrated in the ISS, I think, and rehydrated it and kind of brought it back to life, because that's the nature of those little tardigrades, water elephants. But again, that's different than having it plummeted a rock that rises to a couple thousand degrees Fahrenheit. So, again, highly unlikely that natural structures with embedded organic material are going to survive incredibly intact the experience of deceleration and I won't even say landing. It's more crashing.
I wonder if Jack is able to comment on
it. It won't survive the heat. Let me see if I have it. It won't survive the heat. If a rock or a spacecraft is in orbit at 17,500 miles an hour, it enters the atmosphere, temperatures go up to around 3,000 degrees, give or take. So the heat shields have to be good enough for that. When they come from outside, you know, let's say from the solar system, and they enter our atmosphere directly, then the speeds are getting close to 25,000 miles per hour, and the temperatures go up like 5,000 degrees. So nothing's going to survive on it with 5,000. And by the way, that's what the heat shields have to survive on the spacecraft that's coming back from the moon. You know, if there's any mold on the outside of the spacecraft, I think it's going to be gone. So that's why they collect it on the outside of the ISS, or maybe from the on the inside, and they bring it back and let the scientists analyze it on Earth. But back to you, Roy.
KD2FIU.
Yeah, George.
It may be because of the electromagnetic transmission that is going around it. I have found that there are antennas that I have seen that actually create mold around them because of electromagnetic transmission. And the antennas being left for a long time at higher, these are higher frequencies, probably around 900 megahertz. Just leave it alone. You'll see a white dust around the antenna.
And they say that it's mold spores or mold, not oxidation?
Nobody said anything. I just left it there. And I'm ready to just wipe it off with alcohol. But I have seen this with small phone antennas of the older type that have been left alone for a long time with their battery in it. And I see a white mold developing. They are still being charged.
Okay, but you usually without a good microscope, you can't really tell that it's a mold or something else. There's a lot of white powderish material that can deposit itself on all manner of things, but okay.
I'm not going to disclude the fact that I want to go with the fact that it is mold because there is nothing else.
Okay, not quite sure how you can exclude everything else.
But what can it be?
It could be spores in general, pollen. There's a lot of things that reduce to a fine powder, a lot of pollutants in the air that settle out on surfaces. The description that you're giving me is rather nonspecific and could be organic or inorganic. There's nothing particular, there's no real good way of saying, well, obviously this is a mold if it's just some fine white-gray powder material. It could be anything in the atmosphere. The atmosphere is not terribly clean, especially in our mechanical age, There's a lot of particulates out there, you know, a PM2.5, PM5.0, a lot of particulate matter out there. And it's not inherently all organic. A lot of it is inorganic. So, it, you know, it could be anything, but, you know, I could say that it could be mold, but I could not definitively tell you based on anything so far that I know that definitely can't be anything but mold. There's a difference between those two positions.
There's nothing else that can grow at that rate.
Well, that's assuming that it's growing and not just more of it is depositing. Again, you know, a good microscope would probably solve everyone's question, but... you know, just because there's a patch of some white particulate matter in the same area that gets has a bigger amount, and doesn't necessarily mean mold. And there are other organic, there's bacteria and all kinds of other things. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the kingdom fungi.
But I believe it is. Roy, thank you. KD2FIU, I'll stand by.
Okay, you're free to have that belief. Someone wanted to say something?
KD2FIU. I used to know a person named Mr. Mushroom. That was his last name. He was a real fun guy.
Okay. And no cover charge, ladies and gentlemen.
I do have a question, though.
Okay, I'll put you down on the list, okay? Okay, I guess back to you, Wesley.
KC2FHO.
Hi, John. How you doing?
Hey, good evening. I mean, I was doing the dishes, so I want to make sure I understood kind of the subject. Was the question being asked that could the building blocks of life arrive on an asteroid or comet or something like that, or am I missing what the original question was?
No, that was the original question. Wesley had watched a YouTube that had good old Dr. Tyson, and he was discussing the mold found on the IS outside of the ISS, and he went into a discussion of the theory of life originating off the Earth and traveling through space and crash landing and setting up a life on this world.
Yeah, QSL. All right. So, yeah, I mean, a life form, I don't know. I've heard things, and, of course, years ago about, amino acids and things like that that are the building blocks for life could have arrived this way, and perhaps there's even some evidence that they did. I don't know 100%. Maybe you know more about that. But I was getting a little bit confused because the argument about the temperature on the outside of the rock versus the temperature on the inside of the rock, they're going to be wildly different. You know, by that, saying that something couldn't survive entry sounds a little bit unfounded because by that standard, that means that nobody could re-enter, including the astronauts. So that's a very short time period. You have a large enough piece of, space rock, whatever you want to call it. Whatever's in the middle isn't going to be subject to those ultra-high temperatures.
Well, a couple of points. The idea is not that the organic precursors were introduced on the planet asteroids, because you could already make a case for the precursors to occur, with the elements in their old, lots of water, lots of acids and dissolved rocks and such. So the precursors can certainly be on meteors, and some examinations have suggested that. What everyone's looking for is an actual living cell that's capable of reproducing and branching off into general life on the planet. And that requires a lot of complex chemistry going on all the time and not being interrupted by the surface of the rock you're traveling in being thousands of degrees. Now, you know, I mentioned earlier, I realize you checked in after that, you know, JPL and such can build heat shielding for a significant amount of money that protects all kinds of living things from reentry problems. But the fact that the meteors and comets don't come into being with too much heat shielding, chances are that it will get past the crash landing, because again, the JPL tries to make everyone a soft landing, but comets and the meteors and such don't really do that. Are going to be so disruptive. And is it possible that you could have an amoeba sitting in the middle of a 5-mile rock? Theoretically, yes. In practical terms, how would you suggest that this would have happened and that amoeba would survive that? Or even, say, a spore. How would you get the spore exactly in the middle of a very large piece of rock? So again, chances are that if some organic life form, took a ride on some space object, chances are it would be relatively close to the surface, I would think, rather than in its solid core. So again, is it possible? Yes. Is it probable? In my humble opinion, not terribly. I think there's a lot more probability of life manifesting itself out of nothing on this planet, especially in that, you know, the Goldilocks type of situation that organic life is extremely well suited for this planet, as opposed to there are other planets with other types of climates. So not only are you then matching up a safe landing, but you're matching up a foreign alien organism that sort of was capable of surviving in our environment, whereas it's probably easy to theorize the origin of a life form that comes being on our planet. So it's kind of, if it isn't suitable for our environment, it never forms. So that's the way that I think of these things.
KD2FIU, quick.
Sure, George.
It wouldn't be a life form as we know it. Back to you, Roy.
Well, it would be a lot easier to kind of start life on this planet if it started out as a life form.
And life as we know it. But because our life form has a difficult trek. I'll leave it at that. Back to you, Roy. Thank you.
You're welcome. But again, you know, it's probably easier to... You have to have something to begin with. So if it's a different type of life and now you have a completely different type of life that somehow lands, survives, and then morphs into something that's very Earth-like, is yet another qualifier that it decreases the probabilities even more. But, yeah, again, you certainly have the right to have your opinion about these things, and I'm not telling you that you're wrong. I'm just, I think the chances of something like that are far less than the chances of spontaneous biogenesis on the Earth. Given, you know, you give a billion or 2 billion years, it's amazing what chemistry can do.
KD2FIU. Roy, real quick, I'm agreeing. I am absolutely agreeing. Our composition of chemistry and life is very difficult to imagine on other planets.
Well, again, it sort of depends on, you know, local planets, yeah. I mean, there may be some portion of a moon that might simulate vaguely Earth-like qualities, but in general, you're pretty much going to have to terraform almost anything you find. The chances of coming up with a Goldilocks type of Earth-like planet are not great. They do exist, again, and since there's trillions of planets throughout the universe, the chances of having something very close to Earth are 100%. It might take you about, you know, a billion lifespans with the limitations of relativity to get there from here. But, you know, I mean, you know, it's possible. Say again?
Question K2CJE.
Yes, Ed?
What? Old forms and spores. I thought all these some kind of moisture, heat, and something to feed off.
Well, while it's a spore, it's insulated, isolated, and dehydrated, and it can live for a rather long time. For active life processes, digestion, respiration, reproduction, you're going to need moisture. But like water elephants, they you can dehydrate them, and they just kind of go into suspended animation pretty much, and they don't do anything. But you can keep them, quote, alive. They don't show particularly life signs during that period. But the next number of weeks, months, maybe a year, you can rehydrate it in a Earth environment, and it wakes up and moves around.
What is the difference between all of them?
Well, they've evolved very strong methods to preserve themselves during seasons that are unseasonable for them. One of the big problems you have with a lot of things is, you know, they're designed for a season. They're designed for spring and summer. They don't do too well at fall, and they do rotten at winter. So biological organisms that can't kind of bury themselves deep or go into the water that tends to kind of equalize temperatures down deep enough, you end up evolving a whole bunch of different organisms that have different protective ways of shielding itself from destructive environments. And, you know, with a lot of seeds and such, they have hard covers. A lot of mold has spores, and so the spores will erupt out of the main fungal organism and scatter. And if they land in very dry areas, they just sit there not doing anything until the rains come, and then they grow. So it's just an aspect of evolution. That organisms, because, you know, if we lived on a planet that had the same type of environment 365 days out of the year, there would be a lot less organisms capable of doing that. But since we don't, that's why a lot of different organisms have a lot of protective measures for when their environment is not good for their existence.
I thought that ordinary household bleach, as far as cleaning, kills these items.
Again, it sort of depends on what they are. Some are very well designed. They're shielded. They're waterproof. They have other measures. I mean, there are measures that even evolution can't deal with. But, you know, again, it sort of depends on what the strength of the bleach is. I'm sure that if any biologist worked on the subject, he would find that some organisms are more resistant to being killed with bleach than concentration in others. So it's kind of a matter of magnitude. I mean, you know, it's kind of like the Lord of the Rings. I mean, you know, if you throw the damn ring down to the volcano that communicates with the core of the Earth, you reach a temperature where even the magical ring will dissipate. But, you know, if you throw it into a fireplace, it doesn't do anything. So it's a matter of degrees. some organisms are just very cantankerous and survive all kinds of strange things. There are organisms known as extremophiles that survive and actually grow in environments that would kill us in a minute.
KD2FYU.
Yes, George?
Really good, Roy, and you're right. And they're out there, and we're fighting them. Sodium hypochlorite, 4, 5, 6, 7% diluted, and then bring it to a 10 to 20% dilution with water. It's still one of the strongest antimicrobial solutions that we have to help us, but it doesn't do everything. And what you just said previously is correct, because from what my understanding in life is, there's a lot of stuff we still have to conquer. Back to you, Roy.
Well, there's a lot of stuff we don't even know what it is, because extremophiles are a whole new set of organisms that was discovered, I think, maybe 20 or 25 years ago at the bottom of the ocean, where there's enormous pressures, and there are cracks in the surface that has hydrogen sulfide, sulfuric acid, and all kinds of things leaching into the ocean. And these extremophiles don't just survive it; they actually use those deadly chemicals to extract energy and survive. It's their idea of a donut. So, and there's so many different organisms, we haven't cataloged more than a fraction of them. So there's a lot of totally unknown biology on this world, and every so often people find enormous branches of it in weird places that we would have never guessed.
S.A. Joe?
Yes, John.
Yeah, just wanted to follow up. I agree about almost 99% with everything you responded to my comment, but you're also making a contradiction here. These extremophiles can survive really radical environments, but there's no way they could survive, entry on a porous rock that maybe they're in the middle of. Do you see where I'm going?
I'm not saying that extremophiles are magical. They have their own weaknesses, but their weaknesses, who knows what their weaknesses, but their strengths are our weaknesses. So, but I'm not kind of saying that they're immortal, that there's no way to kill them, that, you have to kind of throw them in Mount Doom or something, like the One Ring. But just it's different. Their means of existing, their nature of metabolizing things is dramatically different. It's not quite as different as the occasional science fiction trope of silicon-based life forms. There's nothing to suggest that there are anything like silicon life forms on the Earth that would require a completely different environment for silicon to act the way organic chemistry does, but it's just kind of an indication that there are some things that can kill us in a second, but organisms happen to thrive on those things just because they're built differently than us.
Yeah, understood. Again, just about 99% agreement, but did hear that little bit of a contradiction there. Anyway. Back to listening. Going to make some dinner for the kiddos here. KC2SHO.
Okay, very good, John. Forgive me if I've lost track of who's next. Wes, have we kind of gone into the subject sufficiently, or is there some other aspect you wish to point out? If that was you, Wesley, you had absolutely no audio. So I don't know if someone's throwing a carrier on you or what.
fell with a comment.
Certainly, Frank.
Yeah, I just texted a friend who worked on the extremophile research 30-some-odd years ago, did a dive on the hot vents in the Alvin, and asked if he's available to jump on here. But, you know, I have no idea whether he's around this evening or not.
Yeah, that would be nice. It's a small, small world, after all. I find extremophiles very fascinating. I think they really are an actual, their own kingdom. I think they gave them their own kingdom. Every so often they discover a new kingdom. And fascinating environment that they're capable of surviving in. That, you know, your wildest imagination. You'd be sterilized at the drop of a hat, you know, under those kind of conditions. And yet, you know, that's their way of surviving. If you take them away from this noxious environment, they die.
Yeah, well, I guess that's why some people will find life in some really extreme environments, like on Mars or, I guess, what is it, some of the moons of Jupiter and that sort of thing. Found life in such extreme places on Earth where life couldn't possibly exist.
Yeah, that's one of the possibilities. You don't know until you find. The problem is you can't kind of predict these things ahead of time. But, you know, as the saying goes from Jurassic Park, life finds a way.
Yeah, kind of amazing. And, anyway, interesting. I haven't gotten a text back. So far, it hasn't broken in here, so it may not be around. He's out in the bay area, so it's the middle of the afternoon yet there. Well, not quite. It's about 5 in the evening, I guess. Not that far west. Anyway, but I figured, okay, let me... I figured, all right, let me shoot out a text to him and see if he's around. If he turns up at... would be interesting. As long as I have the floor here, how was 10 meters today?
10 meters was great. I talked to a couple of stations in Texas, Colorado, Oklahoma. It was reasonably active. It wasn't very active. It wasn't contest active, but it, you know, we had a whole bunch of people kind of stroll over to our frequency and say hello. So it was very nice.
Yeah. The contest this weekend was on 160 meters. Last weekend was VHF. I didn't really... I think I checked 160 once last night. Seeing anything spotted, any DX spotted that I needed. Anyway, it's good to see the band is active. What's interesting, though, is talking about the solar storm earlier in the week, Tamitha Shab, Dr. Tamitha, put up a live feed on YouTube narrating the solar storm and said that indicates that the solar cycle is on the way down. But every example of a similar solar storm in the past, at least the two examples I recognize, there was a second peak shortly afterwards, so I'm hopeful we'll get a biphasic peak before the solar cycle trashes. Well, maybe that's appropriate too, trashes and crashes. Anyway, so we'll see. Okay.
Yeah, I hope so, too. There are people fuddling around with models saying that they think there's a good chance for another biphasic. It happened the last cycle, so I see no inherent reason why it couldn't happen again. Only time will tell. You know, you don't quite know that the sunspot activity has peaked and it's over until you're farther down the curve. So, you know, we'll see what happens. Like I said, this was probably the best 10-meter net I experienced as far as distant contacts for the last, you know, since last winter. So it was very good. You know, a bunch of people in Texas and...